Do you know someone who's having a birthday this month? Don't let the date sneak up and catch you unprepared. Have ProFlower send beautiful birthday flowers. They make flower deliveries easy and affordable. And get this incredible radio special. Yours right now. 100 stunning birthday blooms plus a free glass vase for just $19.99. Play it smart. Go online to ProFlowers.com. Look for the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code FAST. Why overpay at a florist when you can get huge savings on one full 100 stunning birthday blooms for just $19.99 at ProFlowers. They'll even throw in a free vase. With a deal like this, you can take care of all the important people in your life and schedule that special birthday delivery weeks in advance. But hurry, this $19.99 birthday deal won't last forever. And the only way to get it is to go to ProFlowers.com. Look for the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code FAST. One more time, write it down. ProFlowers.com. Secret code FAST. Got it? ProFlowers.com. Secret code FAST. Fast.
Log Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. So, are you still confused about social media, or are you ready to move full steam ahead after listening to my discussion with Lee Plave last week about social media and franchising? And if you missed the show, please access it on demand at blogtalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow. Thanks again to Lee for being my guest. I certainly look forward to Lee coming back for future segments on Franchise Today. Well, our second annual franchise legal series is really picking up steam, and it's really hard to believe today marks the halfway point in this year's seven-part series. So far, and I'm sure I'll feel the same after the series is finished right before Memorial Day, co-producer Joe Caruso has organized one great series, great guests, and some very riveting topics. As always, thank you, Joe, for your efforts. Well, after what many franchise professionals claim was a tough couple of years, franchising seems to be gaining momentum once again. And this is very encouraging news. But franchisors must be prepared not only to handle the increase in inquiries, but in working effectively with today's franchise candidates, who many have indicated are more diligent and cautious than ever before. Matter of fact, many of today's candidates are voluntarily or involuntarily unemployed, soon to be unemployed, or may just want to control their own destiny and are approaching business ownership with the attitude that failure is not an option. Dealing with these candidates, it's essential to exercise extreme diligence in presenting the franchise opportunity, you know, all the way through to executing the franchise agreement and beyond. And I know many franchise professionals are probably thinking, you know, hey, we already do that. Besides, it's the law to fully disclose the opportunity, right? Well, they'll go on to state they've always done things by the book at all times. Well, blah, blah, blah. It really doesn't matter what was done in the past, how it was done, or why it was done. What matters is that opportunities that present themselves today and in the future receive timely, diligent attention at a high level of professionalism in order for a transitioning corporate executive and business professional to even consider a company's franchise opportunity. And if they ultimately do sign the franchise agreement, remit the franchise fee, and commit to investing a substantial sum of money, rest assured these new franchisees will expect and command a high level of accountability from the franchisor and from the system itself. It's good common sense. It should be done that way all the time. Are they going to expect accountability from themselves? Well, not likely, as they'll rarely blame themselves for any part of failure. But they will hold others accountable. Well, my fellow franchise professionals, it's time to press those conservative suits, study your franchise documents, and fine-tune your operations, and examine and perfect your franchise sales process, as any shortcomings will surely raise their ugly heads in the future if today's new franchisees become dismayed, discontented, and or fail in their businesses. They will not hold themselves accountable. Instead, they will blame the person who sold them the franchise or the operations department that they perceive to have provided little or no support, or the franchise executive that they feel show no compassion in forcing them into paying royalties and advertising fees. So, why did I turn what started out to be a positive of increased franchise interest after some years of disappointing results and turn it into a picture of potential problems complete with gloom and doom? Well, basically to encourage and motivate every franchise professional to be on his and her A game and to put their house in order. Not only to bring new franchisees and revenue into the system, but continue to grow their systems with the franchisees that, when attaining a relative level of success, will refer new franchise candidates, validate the franchise system, and possibly look to purchase additional locations in the future. The alternative, of course, is dedication of resource to dispute resolution and possible litigation. Remember that old Fram oil filter commercial, you can pay now or pay later. And that all being said, what a perfect time to introduce today's guest. As the author of the Franchise Seller's Handbook, Warren Lee Lewis is the perfect guest to discuss franchise sales best practices. But, of course, there's more to Warren Lee Lewis than the Franchise Handbook. He's the co-chair, franchising licensing practice at Ackerman Centerfeet, 25 years representing hundreds of franchisors, sub-franchisors, and others within franchising. For many years, recognized by the international who's who of franchise lawyers, Franchise Times, Legal Eagle, Super Lawyers Magazine, the best lawyers in America, and Washington Smart CEO Legal Elite. In addition to the Franchise Seller's Handbook, Warren is also the author of Franchisers, Dollars and Cents, as well as the author of other writings and articles on franchising, and a regular speaker at American Bar Association Forum on Franchising and IFA Legal Symposium Programs, and at congressional and federal agency hearings on franchising, and also a member of industry group that advises the North American Securities Administrators Association Franchise Project Group. Now, Warren has not sold a franchise, so he's not given business advice. Instead, he's given information about the law and how it applies to franchise sales. So anyone seeking legal advice about legal obligations or rights in a particular situation should certainly consult an attorney with a field of practice that includes franchising. Warren, all that being said, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be back to talk about franchise sales.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you, as most of our guests know, you were a guest last year in our first franchise legal series, and we're honored to have you back today. And certainly it couldn't be more timely, as I said. Interest in franchising is starting to pick up speed once again. And, of course, with that, franchise sales are hopefully inevitable as financing continues to loosen up a little bit as the industry also looks at some alternative sources of financing. And as the bankers said at the Small Business Lending Summit recently in Washington, that we need to look at secondary markets as well, and franchisors need to be looked at and will be looked at as if they were the borrower. So there's a lot of housekeeping that's going in order. And so let's start today, because I know we have a lot of people that are really interested in what we have to discuss today. And as you know, Franchise Today has a diverse audience of franchising professionals who have either been involved in franchising for many years or some that may be just beginning their franchise executive career. And I suggest we start that discussion on franchise sales best practices with a look back as to why we have franchise regulations. So if you can kind of give us an overview of that and maybe what was the genesis for these regulations?
Yes. Well, franchising goes back, really back into the 1800s, but it got really picked up steam in the 1950s and 1960s. And during that period, there were quite a few abuses. People were selling franchises who didn't really have the systems that they were promising people and didn't have the trademarks that they said they had, and people didn't know really what their finances were. And as a result, a lot of people were defrauded or didn't get or felt that they didn't get the information they should have had before they went into the franchise. And so as a result, both the Federal Trade Commission at the federal level and the states started getting complaints and got interested. The Federal Trade Commission did propose a rule which was eventually adopted in 1979. But in the meantime, the states moved ahead, beginning with California, and began regulating at the state level as well. So by 1979, you had both the state, generally attorney generals or corporation commissions, getting involved in regulating the sale of franchises to prevent abuse and to require disclosure. And also the Federal Trade Commission entered the picture as well. Now, for many years, from 1979 until 2008, you had the states, which adopted what was called the Uniform Franchise Offering Circular format for disclosure, which was used, the UFOC format, which was used for many years. And the Federal Trade Commission permitted that to be used to comply with the FTC rule. And then just a few years ago, in 2008, the Federal Trade Commission amended its rule, and now we're using a franchise disclosure document. It's new terminology, and there are some new rules that were implemented at that point. And now the states have picked up there, and they're taking the lead from the Federal Trade Commission at this point. This year is really exciting. You had mentioned last year. Last year sales were, you know, for many franchise systems were down. And just so people understand my philosophy in this area, I mean, I see now a very exciting turnaround. Many of our clients are beginning to see leads come back, and they want to make sales. And so we do see sales resuming. Our key is we want sales to be made. We don't want the law to be viewed as a barrier to making sales, but we want the sales to be lawful so that as the executive in the company that you're looking longer term, not just the sale this month or this year, but also you're looking longer term and saying, okay, how can I avoid litigation? How can I avoid a situation where I might have to refund what's paid to me as an initial fee or as royalties later on? And if you follow a lot of these rules we'll talk about during this hour, you will make lawful sales, and you'll be in a much stronger position if somebody comes back later and tries to blame you for their failure.
Sure, absolutely. And as I said, you know, earlier in my opening statements, certainly people will always cast blame in a different direction. So it definitely pays to have your house in order and do things by the book. And so let's take a jump maybe to the far end, because we know that there are franchise laws out there. We have the FTC. We have various states regulating franchising on a pre-sale and post-sale basis. I mean, who actually enforces these franchise laws? I mean, is it the FTC? Is it individual state attorneys general, state corporations commissioners, or some other similar jurisdictional official?
Well, it's all of the above plus the people who buy the franchise. So at the federal level, the Federal Trade Commission rule, there is no filing with the Federal Trade Commission. Some people think that you have to file something with the FTC. That's not true. There is a rule. You have to comply with the rule in all 50 states and in all territories, but there is no filing that has to be made to the Federal Trade Commission. No one can sue. No private person can sue based on a violation of the FTC rule. Only the FTC can enforce that rule. As a result, and because of all the issues that we're running into with the government deficits and that type of thing, budget concerns, there's less enforcement than people might think there is. But to the extent that there's any enforcement of the Federal Trade Commission rule, it's by the actual FTC staff. At the state level, you have about 10 states that require registration, and in the process of registration, they will look at your disclosure document, and they may see things that that don't look right. They then have the right to investigate, so then they can enforce the rules if they choose their own laws. And then in other states where they may have laws that regulate the sale of franchises but don't require registrations, they might require notices to be filed on an annual or one-time basis, and they might receive complaints, and then they would have the authority to go to enforce the law against the franchisor who violated the law. And then, I think that the greatest risk is that you're going to have the franchisee who actually pays the money to you, and then if they lose interest or they fail later on and go to a lawyer, it may be that if there are mistakes that you made or you didn't comply with the law, then that lawyer can come back and say, give us back your money, or damages. And there may be treble damages. They may be entitled to seek attorney's fees from you. There are many different remedies depending on what state is involved.
And of course, everybody's always talked about, you know, kind of the fringe area, like the unknown. I mean, are there certain states where there could actually be criminal charges?
Yes. Many of the states have their felonies to violate the laws, or in some cases their misdemeanors. That's extremely rare in terms of enforcement. So you just need to know that if you're going to violate a state law, it might be that you're committing a crime. Whether or not there'd be enforcement is another issue. That would be, I think, reserved more for people who are really, you know, blatantly defrauding people. I would say the more typical situation is where you've taken the money and there's a basis for saying that you violated the law, and either the state says you have to give back the money, or the person says, give it back to me or I'll cause trouble, or they bring a lawsuit.
Sure. You know, hypothetically, let's say a franchisor has placed a display advertisement in the Wall Street Journal or a national publication like National Restaurant News, marketing their franchise, including a franchise performance representation, which we know is as an FPR, being that their average unit volume is, let's say, $1 million, but it's absent the required disclaimer language, and the FTC would have called the franchisor out on the violation, and I guess take the question in two parts. The franchisor has an item 19 but lacked the disclaimer language, or two, the franchisor has no item 19 FPR. How does this all play out?
Well, the what's now called an FPR used to be called an earnings claim. So people may be still thinking earnings claim, but the new terminology is FPR, or financial performance representation, and that is any kind of information that you give to a prospect that relates to revenues, costs as a percentage of revenue, like cost of goods is 30%, something like that, or profit, any type of profit, 10% net profits, something like that. Any kind of information of that type that you want to give to prospects, and it is very valuable information. If they don't get it from your other franchisees, which is certainly a good source, and you want to give it to them, then you need to include disclosures in your FDD, your franchise disclosure document, and in particular in item 19, and it needs to follow a certain format. Now, if you want to include any information of that type in media, general media, like an advertisement, or on your internet website, in the section of the website that's going to be seen by prospective franchisees, then you need to have a disclaimer that basically gives at least the number of and percentage of outlets who are earning that amount of money. And then you need to have backup in item 19. So if you don't have the disclaimer, that would be a violation of the law. And even if you have the item 19 information, and if you don't have the disclaimer and also don't have the item 19 information, then that would be two basic violations. The Federal Trade Commission may investigate, although, again, they're limited in terms of the resources these days. But I would say it's more likely that a state might get a complaint or might see your ad, and they might inquire and seek to have you fix that, or even seek a penalty against you. It can also be used as evidence against you by franchisees if they invest money in your franchise and later decide that you gave them an unlawful financial performance representation.
Sure, and as you said just a little while ago, the chance, like, for criminal prosecution in this has been extremely rare, but obviously it's on the books, and they can do that. And the same thing is true with state violations or FTC violations. And obviously, I certainly, listening audience, would want to be the one of the with respect to the criminal investigation. But, you know, looking at, again, the negative side of this, generally, I mean, what kind of financial penalty would there be for, like, an FTC or a state violation?
It can be, under the FTC rule, it can be $10,000 per violation. The states would vary. I think the main thing is you don't want to be sued because, you don't want to have to give back all the money if you've given all the support. And if you are sued, just the cost of litigation itself is extremely, you know, that can be the biggest penalty, perhaps.
Sure.
Even if you win the case eventually, if you spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend your brand, then you have lost money just because you maybe gave an opening to the other side.
Well, you know, with the fact that there is little enforcement, I mean, I know I've heard a lot of people, especially in the broker community, that might not be as aware as they should. Because, I mean, face it, there's a lot of brokers and agents out there that are just starting out and certainly don't have experience, nor might they have had the education into what the law is. And then I also hear from some people that say, you know, hey, this is the way it's supposed to be, but quite frankly, I can't see being able to sell a franchise, you know, under these, there's no enforcement, take a shot. I mean, what do you say to those people? I know, I mean, I'm a firm believer in best practices. You're a firm believer. Co-producer Joe Caruso is a firm believer in the best practices. But there are still some naysayers out there that are encouraging and trying to shed this dim light to some of these newer people that go ahead and do it because you're not going to be able to do it the way. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I'd like to give, I mean, I have no trouble telling people, you know, ignore that type of talk, because even if the FTC isn't particularly active in regulating or, say, enforcing right now, at the state level and at the private level, there's been there's plenty of enforcement. And you may never be sued. It may be that you'll violate the law, and maybe after a period of time, you know, it'll be forgotten because of the passage of time. But if you ever do get sued, or you encourage suit because of what you're not following the law, then there are significant consequences. I'll just give you, I mean, I'd just like to give a couple examples. I mean, Dream Dinners is a franchise out of Washington, and they currently have they have units in about 29 states. They were sued several years ago by about 15 of their franchisees, and then they were sued by other franchisees. Eventually, all those lawsuits went to Washington. The people sued. The company was sued. The officers were sued. The spouses of the officers were sued because in Washington there was a marital community law so the spouses could be sued even though they weren't on the contract. The lawyers were sued. The law firm was sued. So here you had all these people. It was a $30 million lawsuit. What happened? It was eventually settled. It was settled this past the end of 2010. The word is that the company itself didn't end up paying, but the law firm did. So somebody paid a lot of money to defend a lawsuit and pay damages. Now, what were the allegations? A lot of what we're talking about here. They met with people without providing them with an offering circular. They had them sign agreements before they gave them the offering circular. They made PowerPoint presentations that weren't exactly consistent with what was in the disclosure document. There were issues about their audited financials. The offering circular was not provided as a single document. It was provided in pieces. Well, you say, well, those are all very technical things. Well, a $30 million lawsuit and the hassle of defending the lawsuit came out of those types of activities. So is it important to follow the rules? I would say they probably look back and say maybe we should have followed the rules a little more carefully.
Yeah, probably.
So there was a penalty there for them.
Yeah, probably didn't use the word maybe either. Probably should have.
Yes.
You know, and you talk about, you know, talking about the personal, the individual liability, salesperson, broker. God, can you imagine going home and telling your spouse, look, you're getting sued for something I did. That wouldn't be a very pleasant conversation. I mean, there are, I mean, obviously there's got to be, you know, financial penalty potential within these lawsuits. I mean, is there potential for governmental sanctions to these individual people? I mean, will they be allowed to sell franchises? I mean, is this something they can be expected to suffer as a consequence? I mean, their livelihood?
Well, they have to disclose it. They're not prevented from selling. They just have to disclose that they were involved and they were, you know, the matter was settled. You know, there are disclosures that are required. So they will have to explain that to prospects.
Right. And while we're talking about examples, wasn't there a situation with Peaberry Coffee that was along the same lines too?
That was a similar situation. And in that situation, they actually they won the case. But it's a Colorado company, Peaberry Coffee. They were at one time, they had a significant number of units. They had, now, if you look them up on the Internet, they are only selling coffee on the Internet. They have closed all their retail stores, apparently, and they're no longer supporting, you know, the people who they sold franchises to. They were sued by 10 franchisees back in 2007. In that case, again, the company was sued, the officers were sued, and the law firm was sued. After a five-week trial, which, you know, that is in the six figures in terms of legal fees, the judge did dismiss the claims and did award royalties for the franchisor. So in that case, they were vindicated at the end. The claims against the law firm were stayed pending resolution. So presumably that has been handled. But they went out as a result of the not following all of the procedures that they were supposed to follow during the sales. They were sued under Colorado law, common law, for fraud and other and misrepresentation. And they went through a two-year litigation with a five-week trial. So even though they were vindicated at the end, they had to deal with all of that evidence that they had that was against them.
Wow.
So I say follow the rules.
Make
a lot of sales and follow the rules at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, can the FTC or state order a franchisor to stop selling franchises?
I have really not seen that. I mean, they can impose so many penalties and restrictions that it may be that that's what happens, that you would eventually be, you know, financially prevented from selling. They can refuse to register people. But generally, they just require disclosure. And so, you know, if they're being investigated or they have orders against them, they have to disclose that to prospects.
Now, I've heard of rescission, like in the state of California. What do you have an example of what possibly could happen under rescission in the Golden State?
Well, in some of the states, and many of the states provide that if the person feels that they've been damaged by you not following the rules, then they can seek rescission, which is a term that a lot of people argue about the meaning of, but basically means they try to put you back to where you were in the first place. And so that can involve, you know, letting you out of the contract, releasing you from the non-compete, for example, and then giving you certain money back or even additional monies that you lost because of the fact that you went into the transaction. And each state is different. Some states permit it and some states don't.
Mm, that's kind of like the proverbial putting the toothpaste back in the tube.
Yes. Yes, it's very hard in franchising because it's not a clear. I mean, people have put their whole life into it, so it's hard to say how you put them back to where they would have been.
Well, one last comment about brokers. I know a lot of brokers really don't take their legal agency in representing franchisors seriously. In fact, they tend to represent that they are consultants representing buyers, which is, you know, usually untrue. Where does this whole level of responsibility lie? You have some franchisors say, well, I do business with brokers because if they make an earnings claim or a financial performance representation, I don't have to worry about it because they're a consultant. I mean, where does this all lie, the sense of agency and the sense of responsibility and the sense of, you know, legality in the whole thing? Who really is responsible? I mean, are there distinct parameters that these laws don't jump over and responsibilities lie over these fences? Where does that all work out?
Well, the laws, I mean, the law defines who franchise sellers are. So a franchise seller basically is anyone who's involved in giving information to a prospect that would facilitate a sale. So a franchise seller would be anybody within the franchise company, any brokers representing the company, anyone who really speaks for the company. And so there may be individual liability. I mean, the broker, for example, might have individual liability as a franchise seller who doesn't comply with the law. But the company, the franchise company, would be found. They would say, well, they were liable because this broker is representing them. So you just need to be. I mean, brokers are very effectively used by many different companies, and I have. Mm-hmm. I don't have firsthand knowledge about all their sales practices, but I mean, they're very effective in many, many cases. But they also need to know the rules.
Sure, absolutely, and it's foolish for anybody to think, whether it be on the broker side or the franchisor side, that this extension of liability doesn't carry over. Whether it be a personal liability or whether it be the corporate liability of the franchisor. At the end of the day, you're right. There are a lot of good, effective brokers, and they're a key component in many franchise sales strategies and should be looked at. But, of course, everybody needs to be playing by the rules and the same set of rules. And I will lump into that category, too, this new faction of brand journalists that are being used out there that are placing these advertorials, these articles that are ripe and full of earnings claims, and then franchise sales agents are pointing their finger and showing people where those articles lie and say, you know, throw up their hands as if to say, hey, look, I didn't make the earning representation. It was written about over there. Go look at it and then come back to me, and I'll sell you a franchise. And, of course, as we know, a lot of these brand journalists and writers are being paid by the franchisor, and I know that is, you know, ripe with breaking, you know, FTC laws, which a lot of the blogging community is affected by now. So the case in point here is that, you know, play the game right. I mean, it is consistent to embrace franchise rules and franchise sales together and do it right. And I know you absolutely agree with that, Warren, correct?
Absolutely. Our clients, I want people to, when they take that initial fee, to be able to keep it and, you know, not be giving the prospect an easy punch, you know, if they don't wait the 14 calendar days or whatever they don't do. Why give an easy argument to the other side that they should get back their money?
Right, absolutely. What is meant by the term private right of action?
A private right of action is when the person who pays the money, the franchisee, can sue you. And you can have a private right of action under common law, which would be just generally you can sue somebody if they defraud you or hurt you in some way. And then you can also have a private right of action under statutes. And so you have the different states with the different laws, and each law has a different set of private rights of action so that you can get damages, rescission, attorney's fees, costs, et cetera. If you don't have a statute like that, it may be more difficult for you to bring a private right of action.
Well, should franchisors be concerned about the potential for a private right of action on a federal level?
No. No.
No.
It's at the state. It's at the state level. There are no real – the private person can't sue under the FTC rule, but they can sue under state law, under the state franchise laws, and they can sue under state common law, just general theories
okay.
of law.
What would cause states, and what would the probability be, states to provide for a private right of action under their franchise statutes?
Well, almost all do, and who have, again, all the states that have franchise laws, they know that they can't enforce the way the private party can enforce. So the states will try to get in if they see a violation. They'll try to jump in, and they might impose a fine, or they might tell the person they're not going to register them unless they offer rescission to the prospect if they see a violation. But they're also, the states these days are also having their budget issues themselves, so they don't have the resources necessary to enforce the laws in every case. So they need to give the private parties the right to sue. And without that right in the statute, in this country anyway, you don't have the right to collect attorney's fees from the other side unless you have some type of statutory right. So a lot of these laws give people that right so that they can seek attorney's fees if they feel that they want a refund of their fees or damages.
Sure, I see. And I want to remind our listeners, we talked a bunch about financial performance representations, FPRs, and to go back to the first in our legal series last year and this year, Lane Fisher talked about FPRs, whether they were friend or foe, and he's got a lot of good insight on FPRs, and that's the first part of the legal series last year and this year, and that can be accessed on demand at blocktalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow. Now, Warren, we've discussed a number of the seemingly daunting requirements and consequences that franchisors face, and we should, as a practical matter, share with our listeners what they can do to mitigate risks and be compliant. So to start with, what are the basics of maintaining the franchise disclosure document, or is lovingly known as the FDD?
Well, you had mentioned that this is a timely discussion. We just passed April 30th, which was 120 days after fiscal year end. So everyone who is selling franchises now should be using a new franchise disclosure document for 2011, because the Federal Trade Commission says that the information that you have in your disclosure document has to be updated at least every year. So the at least every year would be, for most companies, 120 days after your fiscal year end. And for most companies, if your fiscal year end is December 31, then you would need to have updated by April 30th. So we're just beyond that. So everyone should be using new disclosure documents. And there's also a requirement that whatever's in there, if there's some type of material adverse change, such as a new litigation or a bankruptcy, if you want to change the fees that you're charging, for example, that would be a material change, and that would also trigger the obligation to update and change your franchise disclosure document.
Now,
that's your base.
You mentioned very explicitly April 30th. What happens if there are franchisor listeners out there that now are saying, uh-oh, I haven't got it done yet? What would you recommend to them?
Well, stop offering and selling until you update. You're required. Now, there are some exceptions. If you are registered in one of the there are four states, like Maryland, for example, and Virginia, that permit registrations to go beyond the 120 days. So in those states, you can still offer and sell. And they're just for those states. But in all of the other states, and even under some of the state laws, you either have to update 110 or 120 days after your fiscal year end. So if you haven't updated, you just stop offering and selling until you update. And that means that you have to have audited financials also.
Sure. and certainly would be much easier if the term truly was United States and it was all uniform across the board. You know, how do you manage registration or notification states, especially those that have rules differing from the FTC franchise rule? And you mentioned Maryland. I know they might fall into this category too. For example, you know, FDD content that differences in some between 14 and 7 calendar days and 10 and 5 business days. I mean, how does a franchisor really manage all of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have a federal system, so we do have the 50 states, all of which can, you know, make their own laws, and we have the Federal Trade Commission and then the different territorial governments. It's going in the right direction, in my opinion. I mean, since 2008, the Federal Trade Commission did specify what should be in a franchise disclosure document. All of the states have bought into that format. They do have very limited additional pieces of information, like a new cover sheet that you're supposed to include, but all the states have agreed on that cover sheet. And there are just a few things that each of the states will require. So basically, most companies now have a single franchise disclosure document rather than 10 different ones in 10 different states, so they can use that one document in all the different states for the most part. Now, if it turns out that, for example, one state requires some type of disclaimer that nobody else is requiring because of their concern, for example, about your financial statements, for example, then you can create a separate disclosure document for that one state if you don't feel that disclaimer should be given to everybody throughout the country. But for the most part, the franchisors have one disclosure document for all states. The federal rule requires that you disclose people at least 14 calendar days before they sign anything or pay you any money, and then you're supposed to give them a formal filled-in contract at least 7 calendar days before they sign, in most situations, not in all situations. There are a few states that still require first personal meeting, the disclosure at the first personal meeting, which was the old law. And there are a few states that still require disclosure 10 business days in advance, but those states are becoming fewer and fewer. So I would say over a period of time they will eventually phase out. Maryland phased out last year. And so you really just have a few states that still require that. But you do need, I mean, if you are selling, for example, in New York, which is a big state, you still have to follow the first personal meeting requirement, which is that you have to give the FDD when you first meet the person, and then you have to give it to them at least 10 business days in advance. So that you do have to be careful.
You mentioned New York, and I know this has been a course of discussion because next year the International Franchise Expo is moving from Washington, D.C., to the Javits Convention Center in New York, mm-hmm. and I know it raised all kinds of discussion about, well, what about franchisors that are going to exhibit that are not registered in New York? As you said, the first personal meeting given the FDD. I mean, it really is franchisors definitely need to be looking at that now, as opposed to waiting to next spring and trying to juggle at the last moment.
Yeah, it may not be as bad as people think, and that is that what is a first personal meeting? That's an issue. You know, it's like everything else. What is it? What does it really mean? If the expo is going to be in New York, then New York has not changed its law by then, which probably it will not have done because there's apparently no movement in that direction right now. But assuming they still have the first personal meeting requirement, there is law already that says that when you meet somebody on the floor of a convention, that is not a, quote, first personal meeting, although you would think it was, but it's not really because it's out in the public and you're just shaking hands and saying hello to them. That's not viewed as a first personal meeting. So you wouldn't have to, if you're exhibiting there, hand the disclosure document to every person who walks up to your booth. But if you are in New York and they say, let's go and, you know, have a cocktail, or let's go over and have a private meeting or a semi-private meeting someplace in the expo, then that would be a personal meeting and you would have to follow the New York law. So there are distinctions, you know, there are distinctions.
You know, a lot of this comes down to, we talk about doing things right, we talk about doing things within the law, and obviously there's, it comes down to a culture. You know, what do you think are the fundamental ways to build a culture of franchise compliance and best practices within a franchise organization?
I have five words for that: top-down commitment with delegation. And what I mean by that is, if anyone in a company, in a franchise company, if they don't see that top-down commitment to compliance, they're going to cut corners, which is going to hurt the company. You need at the top, the founder of the company or the top executives, to have that vision of the future of one of being litigation-free, of being minimal dispute with franchisee free. That needs to be the vision, not have somebody be in charge who just says, I need to sell five franchises next month. So that's the top-down commitment. But then the only way you can really have compliance is that there has to be delegation. No CEO or salesperson, you know, a top franchise salesperson should be spending time managing the franchise disclosure document, making sure that you're registered in each state. I mean, there has to be somebody who's delegated that responsibility, who isn't involved in the vision part of the company, who isn't involved in the sales part, who's more of an administrative person. And that person needs to be given the authority and the responsibility to make sure that the registrations are in place, make sure that the proper disclosure document is being used, make sure the files are being kept to prove the compliance. And if you have that and you have somebody above them saying, yes, follow this person, or, you know, listen to what they say, then you have compliance. If you don't have it, if the president tries to do it, or the CEO or the salesperson tries to do it on the side, it's you're almost guaranteed that you'll have mistakes. And that really doesn't show commitment. It doesn't show commitment from the top that you really want to comply and that you're going to have somebody who has that responsibility.
Well, I certainly think it's an exceptional five-word statement, top-down commitment with delegation. I know Joe Caruso, who you know and our co-producer, has a great economy of words, and I know he's probably smiling right now because he definitely loves these short statements that are so impactful, and I think top-down commitment with delegation falls right into that category and so perfectly said. But I also think to take that a step further, I think there needs to be more with respect to franchise sales training. And I've told you this before, and of course no show with you would be complete without discussing, you know, the Franchise Seller's Handbook that you wrote. I think this is a tremendous book used for franchise sales, and I highly recommend franchisors get their hand on it. I know I keep it, and mine is all dogged, copied, and I got lines in it and highlights, and I'm not even selling franchises, but I refer to it every day, and I think it's a fabulous handbook. And in the handbook, you reference 7 required basic steps to offering and selling a franchise. You know, give us an overview. What are they? Why are they so important?
Okay. Now, I'm not... just as I have not sold franchises, I'm not selling my handbook. So if anyone wants a copy of the handbook, the electronic, can I just say this, Paul?
I mean, absolutely.
Okay. I mean, I want this handbook. I want as many people as possible to use the handbook because I use it myself. It's a good reminder to me in each case, and I want every franchise person, every franchise seller to use it. It's on the website of my law firm, Akerman, AKERMAN.com. If you go under franchise and licensing, and then it's there in PDF form. Also, if you want a copy that's actually, you know, a color-bound copy, happy to send it to you at no charge at Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N dot Lewis at Akerman.com. Ask me for a copy or copies, I'll send it to you. In the book, we have 4 sections. And basically, the first section is on the 11 rules that you need, or the steps that you need to follow in the sales process. And then we go into the various special situations that might come up that might either add to the rules or eliminate the steps. And then we have permitted activities while you're in the sales process, and we have prohibited activities while you're in the sales process. And so we go through each one. We condense it all down into 52 pages, and we're condensing down literally thousands of pages of law and regulations into what I believe is a great starting point if you're selling franchises. In terms of the 11 steps, we've already talked about a lot of them already. You need to have an up-to-date franchise disclosure document. That's one, to make an offer of a franchise. Two, if you're required to register or file in a state, you need to make sure that filing's still effective, and that it has to be effective when you offer and then also when you sell. What we see often is that people may make an offer while they're registered, but then the registration expires, and then they make the sale after the registration expires, and in that case, they can be penalized. A new requirement that came out in 2008 is that you need to somehow, before you provide the disclosure document to the person, give them some type of notice, either on your website or in an email or in a handwritten sheet of paper, as to the ways, the different ways that they can get a disclosure document. So even if you're out on the floor of an expo, you're supposed to hand them a notice or something in writing before you give them a disclosure document, saying, well, you can get it in paper, or if you want it, we can send it to you in email, for example. That's a new requirement. Then you need to, in the disclosure document on the receipt page, you need to make sure that you've covered you've given the names and other contact information for the actual franchise sellers involved in this particular transaction. In most cases, for most franchise companies, you've already got those names and addresses in the receipt pre-printed. But if there's another person involved, like a broker involved that you know about, you would add them to the receipt before you would give them the franchise disclosure document. Another new rule that came out in 2008 is that you can no longer wait to give the disclosure document until you want to give it to them, like, for example, a discovery date. So if you're talking to somebody on the Internet or on telephone and they want to come in for a discovery day, if they say to you, oh, before I come, I want to see the disclosure document, under the new law, you have to give it to them. Because they've then made a request for it, and you have to give it to them then before they come to Discovery Day. You can't say, oh, well, no, we'll give you that at Discovery Day, which was the practice in earlier times. Sure. Step six is that once you give them the disclosure document, you have to wait 14 calendar days. And you don't count the day that you give it to them, and you don't count the day they sign. So there have to be 14 calendar days in the window between giving them the disclosure document and the time they sign. Then in step seven, you have to get a receipt from them. It might be an electronic receipt. It could be an emailed receipt with their signature. The absolute best receipt is to have them print out a copy of the receipt, sign it, date it. Even if you don't get the original initially, at least they would email a PDF back to you or a fax back to you with their actual signature and date on it. Many lawsuits I've been seeing where people claim they never got the disclosure document, and the franchisor has to pull out the receipt, and even then they say they didn't get it. So it's important to have that receipt. Then step eight is, if you're going to make any changes to the disclosure document other than just adding names and addresses, for example, if you're defining the territory, you have to give all that information to the prospect at least 7 calendar days before they sign. Step nine may not be one that you have to follow in every case. If there's a material change that occurs at any time during the process, you have to go back to go and start all over again, basically. So if you're sued or one of your officers files for bankruptcy in the middle of the sales process, you would have to update your disclosure document and go back to step one and then go back through the steps again and redisclose the person. Then step 10 is that you get them to sign the agreement, and then you have to countersign it. Until you countersign it, there is no sale. So I've seen that where people don't sign something, they don't countersign at the franchisor until after their registration expires, for example, in Maryland or California. That is an unlawful sale. So you have to be aware that you have to countersign in order for the sale to be finished. And then there are, under the new law, there are certain record-keeping requirements after the sale. So those are the 11 basic steps. And then the special situations are situations where you might be dealing with a transfer or a renewal or the sale of an additional franchise to an already existing franchisee. And the handbook goes through each of those situations. And there isn't one answer to each situation. It depends on your level of involvement. It depends on whether you're having them sign a new contract, as to whether you have to follow all of the 11 rules I just talked about, or whether you need to add additional steps. Or you can totally, maybe in some situations, avoid all those steps, depending.
Well, I certainly think it's a must-have on the corner of everyone's desk that's selling franchises, as well as the people that manage them. Matter of fact, don't leave it on the corner. Put it front and center and refer to it quite often. I know I do. It's hard to believe that you did such a great job putting it into 50-plus pages when, like you said, it comes from thousands of pages. What are some of the most common mistakes that you see with respect to all of this?
The biggest mistake I see is that financial performance representations, FPRs, outside of the FDD. Let's face it, any prospect, wouldn't be a real prospect if they didn't want to know how much money they were going to make. So that's either the first or second question they're going to ask the franchise seller. It's not true that you can't give that information. You can give that information. I encourage clients to give it if they have it, and particularly, for example, in a food service business. I mean, you should know typical revenues. You should know typical costs. You should give that information if you have it, and I encourage people to do it. If you don't have a reasonable basis for making those types of statements, then you really just have to tell the person, talk to the franchisees, do your own research, talk to a business person, that type of thing, because otherwise you're going to get in trouble. And most of the lawsuits I see involve some type of a financial performance representation. And, of course, these days it's on PowerPoint, it's in an email. People take notes. I mean, prospects are very, they have their list of questions and they take notes while they talk to you. And that's the first thing that any lawyer is going to ask for if the franchisee becomes disgruntled. Give me your notes. Give me the emails. And if there are these types of claims in the notes and the emails, that's going to be used against the franchisor. The other thing I see is that people making offers and in states where they didn't even realize that they were covered. So that certain law, I mean, Maryland law applies if a prospect is living there, if you meet with them there, if the location will be there. I mean, there are different ways that the law can apply, so that you may not even think that the law applies to you, but if there's any contact with the state, it's possible, not in every case it doesn't happen, but it's possible that you're covered by the law. And then I would say another frequent is that I look at some disclosure documents and they just were not prepared properly in the first place, and they're obviously defective. Sure. And so that's just an easy target for people later on to come back and say, look at all these defects that you had.
Well, great information, Warren. It looks like our time is up, believe it or not. Thanks again for being my guest on Franchise Today, and I always look forward to being with you and hope to do so again real soon. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Remember, today's segment will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. And, of course, please remember to like Franchise Today on Facebook. Next week, co-producer Joe Caruso brings another great guest to the second annual Franchise Legal Series. That's Leslie Curran of Plaive Cook. She'll be on the show and be discussing franchise broker issues in a digital world. You definitely don't want to miss that segment of Franchise Today. The following week, we'll have Adam as my guest, and he'll give an IFA Legal Symposium recap, and then we'll wrap up the Franchise Legal Series on May 26th with franchisee attorney Michael Webster, and we'll talk about independent franchisee associations and why franchisors should love them. And again, I want to thank Joe Caruso. Great series, a lot of great information. I highly recommend people access it on demand at blogtalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow. Again, next week, Leslie Curran will be here. We'll talk about franchise broker issues in a digital world. And as I said, and I know I'm looking forward to it, you definitely don't want to miss that segment. So until next week, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Until then, Franchise Today is out.